Okay, so here we are. This is the second lecture in Chapter 9. Chapter 9 is on unemployment and stagflation. So what causes unemployment? Now, as we talked about last time, full employment is considered an unemployment somewhere between 4 and 6%. One has to be what? Actively seeking employment, right? And there are several groups that are looking for work every year, like college graduates, and we say, well, that's just normal. So if 4 to 6% of the labor force is looking for work, that's normal, so we would define that as full employment. So then the question becomes, well, what causes unemployment beyond that 6%? What caused the unemployment back in the 1930s? What causes unemployment today? Well, it's the same answer. What causes unemployment? Anybody? The only cause of unemployment is excessive inventory. See, when will a business person start laying off workers? Yeah, well, when their sales are down and their inventory starts building up, and at a certain point they say, oh, well, I can't keep on producing X amount when I'm selling less. See, now remember, it's not the inventory that's bad, because every business needs inventory, but it's when that inventory becomes excessive that a business owner will say, hey, I can't produce more than I'm selling forever, so I'm going to cut back my production to get my production more in line with what demand is. And therefore, they start laying off resources. And of course, one of those resources is labor. Now, there are many reasons that can get us to the point where we have excessive inventory. But the ultimate cause of unemployment is excessive inventory. All right? You know, just as there's only one cause of inflation. Remember, the one cause of inflation, at least the simplification of the situation, is when the money supply increases more than goods and services increase. One cause of unemployment, excessive inventory. See, it's simple. See, what is the current unemployment rate? We looked at that last time, right? About 7% or somewhere like that. And the last point I made, you know, in the first lecture on this chapter, is that even though there are weaknesses in how we calculate things like the unemployment rate, the inflation rate, gross domestic product, things like that, these statistics can still be useful as long as the way we calculate them is consistent from month to month and year to year. Because the only reason that we have these statistics is to show us, well, are things getting better or things getting worse? So if we can compare, like the unemployment rate, you know, we calculate the same way month after month. So we compare month one, month two, month three, month four, month five. See, we can at least get an idea of, hey, things are getting better or things are getting worse. See, yes, is it valid? Yes, as long as it is calculated consistently, we can get an accurate comparison from one time period to the next. Right? That's what I just said. What was the unemployment rate at the worst of the Great Depression? The Great Depression is considered like between, during the 30s, you know, 1930 to 39, 1940 or thereabouts. Actually, during that decade, during those 10 years, we actually had two depressions. But most of the time, we just look at the 30s as being the period of the Great Depression. In 1932, the unemployment rate was 25%. So if the best that we can have is somewhere between 4 and 6%, and the worst that we've experienced is 25% unemployment, now, whatever statistic that you look at, you know, whatever you look at as being full, the current unemployment rate, you got something to compare it to, right? If you know the worst and you know the best, And then we say, well, unemployment is, let's say, 8%. Well, that gives you some idea of how bad that is. It's, you know, it's a little bit worse than, it's more than full employment, but it's not nearly as bad as the, you know, 25% we had during the Great Depression. That's really the only reason why it's important to know some of these statistics, is so you get an idea, you can compare things. And is it this good, this bad? How bad is it? How good is it? Tell me more about the Great Depression of the 30s. And I don't think this website's working anymore. I've got to take this off of here. But there are lots of videos on YouTube about the Great Depression. Now, what caused a buildup of excessive inventories in the late 1920s? See, if we're going to look at the Great Depression of the 30s, or we're going to look at the causes, well, we don't look at the 30s, we look at the 20s, the 1920s, because it's what occurred during the 20s that led to the 30s. So what caused the excessive inventories buildup during the 1920s? Business owners were keeping prices high and wages low. You know, this is interesting here that sometime there's one main idea that sort of takes hold of society. It's like a common belief. And if that common belief is not the truth, then ultimately, eventually, bad things happen. And that's exactly what happened during the 1920s. You see, during the 1920s, the common idea of business people is that the way to high profits was to keep prices low, prices as high as possible and wages as low as possible. Now, for a while, that did work. That, you know, that did lead to a buildup of profits. But it only worked for a while because the 1920s was a period of rapid growth. It was a period of many inventions and innovations. It was a very dynamic decade to live. In fact, what's the nickname of the 1920s?
Roaring
20s. I mean, it was really, very, very exciting. Must have been a very exciting time to live. Must have been a very exciting time to live. Well, in a period of many inventions and innovations and the economy is very dynamic, well, in that environment, if you keep wages as low as possible and prices as high as possible, you are going to increase your profits, which did happen in the early to the mid-1930s. But can you see how this led to excessive inventory by the late 1920s? I mean, if you see, when business increased their profits, what are they going to do with those increase in profits? What do business people do with their profits? I mean, do they take this money and take, you know, a couple months off or 6 months and travel the world and or go on a great cruise? See. Yeah, they invest, exactly, in new technology and producing, you know, more goods and invest back in the business. Because, I mean, we're talking about entrepreneurs here. I mean, you know, if you take an entrepreneur and put him on a cruise ship for 2 weeks, well, most of them will go crazy. I mean, if you want to punish them, you put them on a cruise ship. I mean, that's not the kind of people they are. You know, these are people that love a challenge. I remember I saw a movie once. I really wish I could remember the name of it. But it was about this very successful businessman. But it got to the point where, it was so easy to make money. I mean, you know, any millionaire will tell you that the first million is the hardest. And then the second million is a little bit easier. But, once you get to 10 million, 20 million, 50 million, well, it's like falling off a log. I mean, it's easy. And what happens is that in many cases, well, when businessmen have everything going for them financially as a business, well, they want more of a challenge. And in this movie, what happened is this guy just gave up everything, and he went to South America or Africa or somewhere, and there were these two primitive tribes fighting one another, and he took the side of one of these tribes, and he just got involved in their war. And remember, his daughter came to him to visit, and he's in this warfare, and she says, "Why in the world are you doing this?" And he was doing it because it was a challenge. He was looking for a challenge. That's what makes these people tick. It's a challenge. And of course, what history is showing us that when people are so successful, and the game of business becomes not so fun anymore because there's no challenge and it's so easy to win and to succeed and make more and more money. Well, what is the next challenge? I mean, what do these people historically, what have they done? The next challenge is control. See, the game of business is all the cards are stacked in their favor, that that's no longer fun anymore. But let's see, how much control we can impose, on the world. How can we change world events to meet our expectations? See, that's the ultimate challenge. Anyway, getting back to the 1920s, what happened is that these business owners, they put money back into their business, and therefore they produce more. Now, what happens if you produce more but don't increase the buying power of the average consumer? Well, you're going to find yourself with excessive inventory, right? See, if you don't increase the buying power by either lowering prices or raising wages, and yet you produce more, then you're going to find yourself with excessive inventory. And another thing that these business people did is that beside investing into their own business, they invested in risky ventures like the stock market, where the stock market became more like a gambling house than a financial institution, investing institution. Now, if you're this kind of business person and you're looking for excitement, what is more exciting? To invest in things that are very safe, where you're going to know you're going to get a certain amount of return, or things where it's more risky, but if you do it right, if things go your way, you're going to make a whole lot more money. Now, which would you do? Would you invest in something that's really safe, or would you invest in something that there's more risk involved? Well, you're going to invest in something where there's more risk involved, especially if you consider that, hey, this is play money anyway. I mean, you've already got three or four houses, and you've got, six or seven cars, and you own property all over the world, and you've got all this stuff is paid for. You got boats, and you've got all these material things. So this money that you're investing in these high risk ventures is just like, well, it's just play money. It's just funny money. All right, because what you're looking for is a thrill more than anything. So now we got two things here. On the one hand, we're building up excessive inventory. And on the other hand, we've invested in high risk endeavors. Now, once the economy starts headed south, which type of investments are going to fold first? Those very safe, solid investments or the risky investments? Yeah, the risky investments. See, so here's what happened. Build up excessive inventory, laying off of workers, growing unemployment, the economy starts to head south. And once the economy starts to head south, a lot of those risky investments start to head south. they start to go broke. And then eventually it becomes a stampede. I mean, it becomes, instead of people being optimistic about the future, they turn pessimistic. And remember, people, investors, we all make decisions based on our expectations of what we think is going to happen in the future. So once things started to head south, we started to get more unemployment. Well, what happened? Well, it becomes a herd type of mentality, and everyone starts running for, someone shouts fire, and everyone starts running for the exits. And so what happens? Well, things start to collapse very quickly. And that's what happened in the early 1930s. All right? See, what caused the severity of the unemployment in 1932? Now, all that I've explained to you so far led to the buildup of excessive inventories in the late 1920s and led to growing unemployment in the early 30s. But they did not lead to the Great Depression. Now, what caused the Great Depression are policies that we put into effect as a result of the unemployment. So in other words, the Federal Reserve and the government took action in the early 30s that made matters much worse and pushed the economy into a depression. Now, the first thing, there are three examples of that. The first example is the Smoot-Hawley tariff. The Smoot-Hawley tariff, 1932, was the highest protective tariff in our nation's history. Now, what a tariff is a tax on an import. So when foreign countries have to, when they import something in the United States, if there's a tariff on that product, then they have to pay it like a tax on it. All right? So the thinking here was so many Americans are becoming unemployed, so if we put high tariffs against foreign products, we're going to force the prices of those foreign products to increase. And as a result, Americans will buy more American-made products. This will stimulate business in America, and it will help bring us back to full employment. Now, did y'all hear what I said? We're going to put a high tariffs against foreign products. People buy more American products, more American jobs. Okay, true or false? I mean, is that good economics or bad economics? I mean, is that truth? Is it truth that if we put high tariffs against imports that we're going to have more employment? No, it's not truth. See, that's an untruth. It's false. It goes against the laws of nature. Instead of leading to more employment in America, it led to more unemployment. See, there's lots of reasons. You know, for one thing, when we put a tariff up against foreign products, just for the purpose, now the next chapter coming up after this one is just about international trade, and we talk a lot about tariffs, and there are times when tariffs make sense. Okay, but one of the worst arguments in favor of tariffs is to save American jobs. I mean, that doesn't hold any water whatsoever. And here's why. If we put tariffs against foreign products, we force an increase in price of those foreign products, but that means that many American businesses now don't have to worry about that foreign competition. See, I mean, if foreigners have to raise their price by 20%, Americans can raise their price by 10% and still underprice the foreigner. See, they still have a price advantage. Okay, now we'll rely on other companies. I think I was going to talk about that next. Let me Let me see if I, you know, if this is what you're talking about. My next point was that how many Americans owe their jobs to foreign demand? A lot of Americans work for companies that sell to foreigners, right? Now, where do foreigners get their money ultimately to buy American products? Because they need American dollars. How do they get American dollars? They sell to America. They sell to America. We give them dollars. They take those dollars and they buy from America. See? Now, if we buy less from them, see, not only are they going to have fewer dollars to buy from us, but what causes unemployment? Excessive inventory. How can we have excessive inventory? A decline in demand. If these foreign countries used to sell a lot to us, and we say, oh, well, no, we're not going to buy from you anymore, well, the demand for their products goes down. They find themselves with excessive inventory. They start to experience more unemployment. Now, two things. They got less dollars, fewer dollars, and they got growing unemployment. So what happens to their ability to buy from us? And it goes down. And as foreigners buy less from us, business sells less, they produce less, and they start laying off workers. See, that leads to more unemployment, not more employment. All right? So anyway, that's the Smoot-Hawley tariff. Yeah. All right. Again, he told me he had to leave early, so I do appreciate that. So that's one thing that led to made a bad situation worse. Now, another thing that the government did, see, the first two is something the government did. The third is something the Federal Reserve did. But the other thing the government did in the early 30s is to raise taxes. Now, why did we raise taxes? Well, Herbert Hoover was president at this time, in these very early 30s, and he was a business person. You know, he came from the corporate world. And the prevailing belief back in those days was that ultimately the government should have a balanced budget. And with growing unemployment, tax revenues went down, so the government had to borrow more to meet its commitments. Plus, there were, the big social programs came later under Roosevelt with his New Deal programs, but even before Roosevelt's New Deal programs, we did have social programs. Now, we didn't have unemployment benefits. That did come in later under Roosevelt. But, there were, government, social programs, designed to help the poor, needy, and the unemployed in certain ways, but not unemployment benefits, per se. But anyway, what happened is that as unemployment got worse, well, tax revenues went down, the national debt started to increase, and if you believe that it's best to have a balanced budget, how do you solve the problem of an increasing government debt? Well, you raise taxes. You raise taxes, you bring in more revenue, you balance the budget. Well, that may sound good to someone who really doesn't understand the bigger picture. But the bigger picture is that if the problem is insufficient demand, which it was, and you raise taxes on those very people that already aren't buying enough, what's going to happen to consumer demand? It's going to go down even more so. And what happens to the unemployment problem? Well, it's going to get worse. And the third thing we did is here's something the Federal Reserve did, decrease the money supply. Now, you got to really stretch your imagination on this one. Why in the world In a period of growing unemployment, where the problem was insufficient demand, would the Federal Reserve take money out of the system? Well, you really got to know history to answer this, because it's almost illogical. But here's the reasoning. The reasoning is this: because the unemployment problem started here in the United States and spread to the rest of the world, there were lots of foreign nations that had the money here, usually in the form of gold and silver. And they looked at America and they said, man, bad things are happening over there. You know, if things get worse, I mean, we got all this money over there. We might not be able to get our money out. So they started to take their money out of America to bring it back home. And the Federal Reserve looked at this and said, well, this is a big problem. So what can we do to convince foreigners not to take their money out of America, but keep it here? Well, what we can do is that we can take action to raise interest rates. If interest rates go up, then foreigners say, well, there's risk involved here with us keeping our money in America, but we are earning these high interest rates, so that overcomes our fear. And because the return is so good, we'll keep our money in America. Well, how does the Federal Reserve increase interest rates? Now, remember, there are only two interest rates that the Federal Reserve actually controls: the federal funds rate, and the discount rate. All right, and all other interest rates are determined by market forces, the supply and demand for money in the loanable funds market. That's what determines interest rates. And as we learned in an earlier chapter, what the Federal Reserve can do is that they can influence the liquidity of banks, right, by their monetary policies. Now, I'm not going to go into that all again. I mean, we've already, you know, had this. All right, so what happened? How does the Federal Reserve increase interest rates? They take action to decrease the money supply by decreasing the liquidity of banks. All right? So you decrease the money supply, and interest rates start to go up. You know, when something becomes more scarce, everything else being equal, the price goes up. The price of borrowed money is interest. So interest rates start to go up, and the Federal Reserve figured, well, now with these higher interest rates, foreigners will keep their money in America. Well, if you just concentrate on that line of reasoning, you say, well, okay, that makes sense. But if you can see the bigger picture, if the problem for society is insufficient demand and you take money out of the system, what's got to happen to demand? It's going to go down. And if it goes down, your unemployment problem is going to get worse, not better. So it's kind of like, you know, the analogy I like to use here is, you know, let's say that that you're standing up and someone comes behind you and pushes you, so you fall down. But you're able to catch yourself, and here you are. You're down, but you're on all fours. Now, that's what happened in the latter part of the 20s and the really early 30s. I mean, the inventory buildup in the late 1920s led to growing unemployment. So, in essence, the economy was pushed, fell, but was on all fours. Now, what happens if you're on all fours and someone comes along and kicks out your left arm, kicks out your right arm, and then kicks out your left leg? What's going to happen? Yeah, you're going to fall right on your face, correct? Well, that's exactly what the what happened in the early 30s. I mean, the economy was on its all fours in the early 30s, and then the government came along, kicked out the right arm, kicked out the left arm, and then the Federal Reserve came along and kicked out one of the back feet. So obviously the economy collapsed. And that's a pretty simplification. It's a simplification, but it's a picture of what happened and what caused the Great Depression of the 1930s. All right? Now remember, economic principles are economic principles. They haven't changed. All right? See, can the same thing happen today? Can authorities, either in the federal government or the Federal Reserve, think they're a certain policy will make things better, but in reality make things worse? Well, sure, that certainly can happen. In fact, it has happened. See, now what are the two types of fiscal policy? There's discretionary policies and automatic stabilizers. And I think we've talked about these before. See, a discretionary fiscal policy is a policy that someone has to make a decision. Well, in this case, it would be like, you know, Congress. You know, we've got a problem. So Congress gets together and they say, oh, well, let's do this about the problem. And then they institute a new program to fight the problem. Well, that's a discretionary fiscal policy. An automatic stabilizer is also a fiscal policy, but it's something that takes effect automatically, that no one has to make any decisions about, like unemployment benefits. You know, if you become unemployed, well, if you meet the qualifications of the law, then you receive X amount of dollars according to the law for X number of weeks according to the law. No one has to make any decisions, right? And that just goes into effect automatically. Now, all economists, both Keynesian and Austrians, agree on the validity of automatic stabilizers. The disagreement comes in when it comes to discretionary fiscal policies. Keynesians tend to rely more on discretionary fiscal policies, whereas Austrians are more suspicious of the benefits of discretionary fiscal policies. And that's a major difference between Keynesians and Austrians. What are the failings of discretionary fiscal policies? Well, now, I'm talking here as an Austrian. Okay, an Austrian economist would look at discretionary fiscal policies and they would say, well, for these reasons, discretionary fiscal policies very often cause more problems than they solve. Well, one reason that Austrians are suspicious of discretionary fiscal policies is time lags. Now, remember, there are always three time lags. There's the recognition lag, okay, the decision lag, and the action lag. You see, we can have an unemployment problem, but do we know instantaneously when it begins that, oh, we've got an unemployment problem? No, it takes time. You know, it starts, but it starts slow, and it's you know, we don't notice it. And then time goes on, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And at some point, we wake up and say, hey, we got a problem. Well, that's the time lag. Now, the decision lag is, oh, well, we got a problem. What should we do about it? Now, with 535 members of Congress, two different political parties, it takes time for them to come to consensus. You know, a year, maybe 2 years. And then, of course, once we decide what to do about the problem, it takes time to implement what we've decided to do. Well, that's called the action lag. Well, how much time has gone by between the problem started and we actually come in and start trying to solve the problem? Well, it might be a year, it might be 2 years, it might be 3 years. Meanwhile, the problem's changed. So our remedy for the problem, I mean, we might be trying to solve a problem that doesn't even exist anymore. And so what Austrian economists say is that with discretionary fiscal policies, we're always out of step with ourselves. We're always a dollar late and a dollar short. See? Instead of being a stabilizing force, these discretionary fiscal policies actually are destabilizing. You know, they make matters worse instead of better because of these time lags. See, if we had an all-powerful king or an emperor, and that emperor had all knowledge, and that emperor had his only priority was to make things better economically, then would discretionary fiscal policies work? Well, according to Austrian, yeah, in that case, they might work. But the fact is, you know, we don't have an emperor, and very often decisions are not made, you know, for economic reasons. But when you got members of Congress, those decisions are very often made for political reasons rather than economic reasons, which simply makes the economic problems worse, especially over the long run. Another thing would be to know the value of the multiplier. See, when we've already talked about the Keynesian multiplier. When a dollar is injected into the economy, no matter what source that comes from, there's a multiple effect on it. As dollars changes from person to person, people save, they spend most of it. People save, they spend most of what they receive. People save a part of what they receive, spend most of it. You know, and eventually, you know, we're going to get down to the last penny. But that's what's called the Keynesian multiplier. Well, in order to make correct discretionary fiscal policies or decisions, we have to know what effect will an increase in, let's say, you know, $1 billion have on the economy. I mean, if we increase spending by $1 billion, you know, what will be the ultimate result of that increase in spending? Well, partly to answer that question, we would have to know the value of the multiplier. And the Austrians would say, you can theorize this and you can study it, and you can put fancy names, you know, and doctor before, you know, these statisticians, and but when you get down to it, it's still all an estimated guess. You know, it's an educated guess what the multiplier is. And yet, if you don't know what the multiplier is, then how do you know exactly how much to stimulate the economy by? And the other thing is politics. Well, I already talked about that. You know, most discretionary fiscal policies, especially lately, you know, have not been made. I mean, number one, even if they were made for economic reasons, you're still not going to get good results, because who are most of our politicians? Where are they? I mean, are these economists? I mean, where do these politicians come from? Most of them are lawyers, yeah. You know, most of them, I mean, you all know more about how the economy works than, you know, 95% of Congress. All right? You know, there's no law says that a politician has to take a course in economics. So what happens is that, you can say, well, discretionary fiscal policy is okay, but if, okay. Again, you know, he told me he had to leave early. So in reality, I mean, even if politicians were intended to make decisions based on economics, chances that they would make the right decisions are very small, because they've got very little knowledge of how the economy works. All right? But what makes matters worse is that the majority of times they don't make decisions based on economics anyway. They make decisions based on politics. All right? Okay, structural changes. See, it's kind of like you've got an automobile engine, and let's say it's running good, it's purring right along, but it's in neutral, it's parked, and you really don't, there's a knock in there, you think, well, maybe there's something wrong here, but you don't really know, you're not a mechanic, you don't know anything about engines, but you start tinkering around with this motor. You start pulling wires and you start, doing this and doing that. Well, see, what's going to happen? Well, maybe you had a minor problem, but once you start tinkering around with something you don't understand, chances are you're going to end up with a bigger problem. Well, that's what's called a structural change. Once we start tinkering around with the inner workings of the economic system, if we don't know what we're doing, very often we make matters worse instead of better. Accurate forecasting is another failing of discretionary fiscal policies. In order to make the correct discretionary fiscal policies, we have to be able to look ahead and say, well, where are we heading, and how fast are we going there? Are things getting better? Things getting worse? Now, if our forecasting is not good, in other words, if we anticipate something happen, but that our anticipation is incorrect, then we're going to make bad discretionary fiscal policies. We may fear a problem that's not even a problem, and yet we take action against it, because our forecasting was off, and we end up making matters worse instead of better. And international events. There's a big failing for politicians that make discretionary fiscal policies, and that they very seldom consider the international impact of their policies. They look at the American economy as if it were a bubble, and we were kind of like an island unto ourselves, and so they make decisions to do this or to do that without considering the international implications. But the truth is that America is only a small part of the world, and what happens in the rest of the world affects us. Okay? So unless a person that makes, or people like Congress, makes these discretionary fiscal policies with an understanding of the impact of these policies on the foreign sector, then chances are we're going to make matters worse instead of better. And, of course, ignorance of economics. The whole premise of discretionary fiscal policies is that we understand the problem and we understand economics, and these decision makers use that knowledge to make good economic decisions. Now, from what I've just said, how far is that from reality? That's a long way from reality. So what are some recent laws that change the economy structurally? The health care bill, 2,700 pages, and there's 22,000 pages of regulations that go along with it. The financial reform bill, 2,100 pages. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was part of the financial reform bill. Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, called FATCA. What I'm going to look at these briefly, but what I'm talking about here is that see, we've taken the discretionary fiscal policies. You know, we, as a result of the financial collapse of 2007, 2008, which, you know, the last chapter is all about, we brought a lot of these programs into existence. So the question is, will these programs make things better or make things worse? So how does the health care bill work? It must cover everyone who applies. So, you know, we can't turn down anyone for health reasons. Everyone must purchase insurance or pay a fine, $750 for an individual to start with, $2,250 per family. Well, that is after a certain time. Now, when does this penalty start to kick in? It was supposed to have kicked in the year 2014, but there were so many problems with it, and it would have been such politically unpopular. And there, of course, there was an eye on the elections that, you know, just took place yesterday, that this was postponed for a year. So this fine, or the Supreme Court ruled it a tax and not a fine, will begin January 1st. So all of you are going to have insurance or pay a fine starting next year. That's part of the law. Companies with 50 or more employees must offer health insurance or pay $750 per worker. And that goes into effect next year also, in just a couple months. And we talked about this before, right? So as a result, what a lot of companies doing right now? Yeah, they're, you know, they're cutting back the hours of their full-time employees to get them under that 30-hour week threshold so they don't have to pay the fine, which has a tremendous impact on job opportunities for you when you, you know, when you graduate. How does the financial reform law protect big business? It identifies which non-bank financial institutions might cause instability if they fail, if so, stringent regulations by the Fed in exchange for protection. So what has happened as a result of this financial reform law that has taken effect since the crash of 2008 is that the government has become more or less a partner with big business, especially big banks. So what they've said is that they've said, we'll promise to protect you in case things go bad, but in exchange for that guarantee of protection, we are going to regulate you. Okay? So that's a big change. I mean, that's a big structural change. See, many American businesses... not voluntarily, by the way. This is involuntary, and for the most part. But they become the partners with government. Okay, and each, you know, one says, "All right, you protect me," and the other says, "Okay, but I'm going to regulate you more." Now that's a big simplification, but, and we're going to talk about this in more detail, but that's. They'll give you an idea of the structural change that's taken place since 2008. Which firms can get preferential treatment? Participants in rent seeking, leading to a symbiotic relationship between politicians and business. Now, what does that term rent seeking mean? Rent seeking, as you recall, is when businesses plow money into D.C. to influence Congress to get laws passed favoring their business. That's called rent seeking. All right? So when you get this big business, one of the problems is that when government partners with big business and says, well, we're going to protect you, that gives big business an advantage, an economic advantage over the smaller business. And so what has happened, another structural change since 2008, is that we have fewer smaller businesses, and the big businesses that we have are bigger. Okay? That's a structural change. And so what happens is that once you get big business, then they can plow money into D.C. to help this politician, that politician financially, and they get laws favoring them to the disadvantage of smaller business. So you got to keep in mind there's a big, big difference between big business and little business. You can't group business and business people all in one group. There's a huge difference between big business and little business. Okay? What is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? Established by the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Law, under the Fed but not responsible to the Fed. Impose rules on banks, not approved by the Senate, and receives 10% combined earnings of the Fed. Now, essentially, what the Financial Protection Bureau is that it has a great deal of power over our financial sector. Now, this is a big simplification, but it gives you an overview. Now, according to our Constitution, the president can propose a law, sends that to the House of Representatives, they vote on it, and then it goes to the Senate, and they vote on it, and the majority, in order for the law to pass, essentially it takes the majority of Congress, all right? So in this way, the president cannot simply bring institutions into existence without the approval of Congress. But that's not what happened with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. What happened with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is that it came into existence via executive order of the president. He simply issued an executive order. He brought this, control that Congress has is that Congress controls the purse strings. So the president can propose something, but if Congress says, well, we're not going to fund it, then it's not going to happen. But what happened with this bureau is that through executive order, see, it never went to Congress. Through executive order, it was established, and then it was tucked under the Federal Reserve, and 10% of the funds of Federal Reserve supports it. So it's not dependent upon Congress for its funding. And Congress had nothing to do with its implementation. So we have this bureau that has tremendous power over our financial industry, but was not brought into existence by Congress and is not dependent upon monies from Congress. You find that interesting? Now, what is FATCA? Foreign banks must identify Americans and provide financial information to the IRS or face a 30% of the bank's U.S. income. See, when taxes have increased, it's like everything else. You know, businesses do what they do to avoid those higher taxes. And so they've done things internationally. And the government said, well, we're going to capture a lot of this money that's not being accounted for in foreign countries. And so what they passed a law that went into effect this year called FATCA. And what that does is that it forces all financial institutions in the world to divulge to the American IRS full information on all Americans. And if they don't give full information on one American that has an account with them, then then the United States government will take 30% of any monies leaving America into that institution. So that's a law that just came into effect, and that's a structural change. See, what I'm talking about here is structural changes since the collapse of 2008. What effect of big government on national debt? 40% of the national budget is borrowed money. 70% of federal securities are purchased by the Fed. Imagine that. You know, how does the federal government borrow money? They sell securities. Who can buy those securities? Anybody. But who has been buying most of those securities? The Federal Reserve. And where's the Federal Reserve gotten the money to pay for a lot of these securities? From thin air, right? They've simply created the money. What are unemployment benefits? Okay, again, we're talking about fiscal policies. Cash transfers provided to unemployed workers who actively seek employment and who meet other qualifications. Okay, I'm going to try to do what I can here. We're kind of running out of time. What is the Phillips curve? Shows an inverse relationship between inflation and unemployment. What is stagflation? Unemployment and inflation increase at the same time. And why is stagflation a dilemma for policymakers? By using typical Keynesian tools, whatever you do to fight one problem, the other gets worse. So if you've got unemployment and inflation at the same time, and you depend on demand policies, well, if you increase demand, inflation gets worse, but if you decrease demand, unemployment gets worse. And that's why stagflation, where the economy is stagnating and inflating at the same time, is a policy dilemma. All right? See, the conflict is fiscal and monetary policies can move in opposite directions. And that can happen. You know, you can have, when you've got stagflation, you can have monetary policy saying, well, inflation's the worst problem, and you can have fiscal decision makers saying that unemployment is the worst problem. So you can have fiscal policies trying to stimulate the economy and monetary policies trying to restrict the economy at the same time. Imagine that. What is the Full Employment Balanced Growth Act of 78? Mandated the Fed to ensure full employment and stable prices. We've talked about before. Is this possible during periods of stagflation? No, impossible. How do you fight inflation and unemployment at the same time? Well, you can't. It's like jumping up and, you know, like going backwards and forwards at the same time. You can't do it. What is the cycle imposed by monetary and fiscal policies? Choices are made and then reversed as each problem gets better and worse again. Now, I'm going to pick this up next time because this is so important, but here's a picture of stagflation. Okay, it's very simple. When the aggregate supply curve shifts to the left, what happens? Nuts. What happens to when aggregate supply curve shifts to the left from S to S prime, what happens to the price level? Goes up. What happens to Q, meaning gross domestic product? It goes down. Well, if prices go up and GDP goes down, what do we call that? Stagflation. Now, if this is the cause of stagflation, what is the solution? If the cause of stagflation is a movement to the left of the aggregate supply curve, what's the solution? Exactly. Very simple. To move it to the right. Now, one thing that affects the aggregate supply curve a lot are costs to business. If you can lower costs on business, then they can supply more at every price, and aggregate supply curve will shift back to the right. Now, how do you lower costs on business? Well, if you're talking about government policies, you can lower taxes on business. If you lower taxes on business, their costs go down, aggregate supply shifts to the right, the price level goes down, and employment improves. Right? Anyway, we've run out of time. I'll just kind of pick this up maybe 5-10 minutes next time. But next time we are going to get into the next chapter. So read chapter 10, for next time. And I'll see you all next time.